So, welcome to the Yates, second half of the Yates podcast. Right, this should be a little bit shorter than the previous one. We're going to look at the next two poems, Leda and the Swan and the Second Coming. And they're both connected to Yates's ideas about what he calls the gyres of history. If you look at the second Yates page, you see those spiral things going up, talking about the gyres of history. One of them is an animated GIF the second one, that shows kind of the way these spirals pass through time. Yates's belief is that history moves in these big 2,000-year cycles. And he says that, you know, these cultures rise up, they get really good for about 1,000 years, and they reach kind of their ultimate achievement about 1,000 years in, and then they start this gradual decline for about 1,000 years, and then a new gyre takes over. And when these new gyres start, he says it's when God, man, and beast come together. Now, the first poem is the idea that is Leda and the Swan talks about God, man, and beast coming together to begin what he calls the gyre of the swan. And then that's replaced by the gyre of the dove. And the second coming is about the ending of this gyre of the dove. So let's start with a little bit of background, maybe that'll help you understand the story of Leda and the Swan, right? We're talking about, this is Helen of Troy's mother, Leda, the most beautiful woman on the face of the earth. Right? Zeus, the king of the gods, lusts after her. Zeus lusts after many human women and turns himself into multiple forms in order to have sex with them. He turns himself into a bull, turns himself into a golden shower, turns himself into an eagle, turns himself into multiple human men so that these women think they're having sex with their husbands, right? In Leda's case, he turns himself into a swan. And if you just Google Leda and the Swan, we're not talking like the little things by Lakeside. We're talking about like this gigundo 10-foot-tall swan that comes to Leda and rapes her. And Yates talks about this, right? He says, a sudden blow, the great wings beating still above the staggering girl, her thighs caressed by the dark webs, her nape caught in his bill. He holds her helpless breast upon his breast. And in those first four lines, right, because we see that this is written like a sonnet, 14 lines, we get a broken line there, right, in line, what is that, line 12 and 13, 8, 9, 10, line 11 and 12, but in reality, this is a 14-line sonnet. This first quatrain, this first kind of setting of the argument talks about how Leda and Zeus come together. When we begin, we see Zeus, the swan, described as a sudden blow, right? He's the guy doing the action. Leda is completely passive here, right? But Zeus is described as the great wings. That's the first time we see him, this metonymy, right, where part substitutes for the whole. The wings are beating. The first time we see Leda, she's just a staggering girl in that second line. So one's a part and one's the whole. One's active and one's passive. Then the next time we see Leda, is the second half of that second line. Her thighs are caressed by the dark webs. So the second time we see each one of them, it's her thighs. We get her expressed by a part. And his dark webs, right? His feet, basically. Okay, so not only is it, they're both parts, so they're coming a little bit closer together. And then the third time, that second half of the third line, her nape caught in his bill. The back of her neck caught in his bill, the front, basically, of his neck, the front of his face. So we're really close together now. Until the fourth line, he holds her helpless breast upon his breast. Breast to breast, right? So we get this kind of V-shaped connection coming down as we walk through those lines. As far apart as they can be, coming down to breast. And then these questions in the second stanza. How can those terrified, vague fingers push the feathered glory from her loosening thighs? And how can body, laid in that white rush, but feel the strange heart beating where it lies? And now, I guess this is the time, as good a time as any to bring up, this is a peculiarity of Yeats's poetry. When Yeats asks a question, he's not asking a question. He's telling you something. It's the most emphatic thing he can say. Back in Easter 1916, what if excess of love bewildered them until they died, right? Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart. When may it suffice? Those questions, they're not questions. Think of them as three exclamation points for Yeats. And he says, those terrified vague fingers can't push this swan away. And if you look at the second page for Yeats, those Yeats images, you see that very, right, that bas-relief of Leda and the Swan that Yeats based his poem on, right? This is this huge swan who's attacking her, right? And believe me, it's attack. This isn't about sex. This is about violence. How can body laid in that white rush but feel the strange heart beating where it lies? Strange? Why? Because it's both the king of the gods and it's this animal. And then in true sonnet form, after the first eight lines, the octave, comes kind of the counter-argument, kind of the resolution, the sestet or the sextet, the last six lines. And here it looks like it's seven, but it's not. A shudder in the loins engenders there the broken wall, the burning roof and tower, and Agamemnon dead, being so caught up, so mastered by the brute blood of the air. Did she put on his knowledge with his power before the indifferent beak could let her drop? And wow, this is impressive, right? A shudder in the loins. We get what that means. He has an orgasm and he's done, right? He's spent what the technical term is the refractory period. And what does that cause? Well, who are the children of this union? Leda actually has four kids, Castor and Pollux, and then Clytemnestra and Helen. Now, Helen marries Menelaus, who is the king of Sparta, and Clytemnestra marries Agamemnon, who's the king of Athens. Agamemnon has grand designs, right? Greece isn't the greatest culture on the face of the earth at this time. Right, that's across the Aegean Sea, over by near Turkey. That's Troy. And Zeus is just itching for a reason, and he knows he can take them, right? If I get all the Greek city-states together, and we go over there as a group with me in charge, we can destroy Troy. Well, when Menelaus's wife gets taken, Helen, it says that she's taken, but let's face it, she ran away with Paris, a prince of Troy, goes back to Troy. Agamemnon has his excuse. So he calls all the members of the city state. Are we going to stand for this? They've kidnapped this guy's wife. Da, 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 da. Let's go over there, clobber some people. Now the gods, right, the pantheon, the Greek and Roman pantheon, they don't want this to happen because their very existence is reliant upon this. Both Troy and the Greeks worship the same gods. And how do the gods eat? How do they feed? How do they stay alive? Through the worship of humans. So no matter which side wins, be it the Greeks or the Trojans, they are going to lose kind of half their sustenance because they're going to wipe out the other half of the people who worship them. So they don't want this to happen. And they put this off for a long time. Right? They tell Poseidon, Zeus tells Poseidon, in fact, do not let the seas be able to take us there. But Agamemnon works a deal with Poseidon. He says, listen, Poseidon, if you give me fair winds and a following sea, I will sacrifice to you the very first thing I see when I walk home today. Poseidon says, a gift just for me? Food just for me that I don't have to share with the other gods? All right, you got yourself a deal. And to be fair to Agamemnon, which I do not want to be, but to be fair to him, maybe he thought he was going to see some cattle or some sheep or some goats or chickens or something like that. But no. What he sees instead, the very first thing, is his daughter with Clytemnestra, Iphigenia. So what do you do? Well, I think a decent parent would say, deal's off. Sorry, can't do it. But not Agamemnon. He takes his daughter. He brings her to the cliff and he kills her, sacrifices her to Poseidon. And suddenly the winds shift, the sea gets good, and he runs down to the ships, and boom, they take off for Troy right then. And that's it. And here's Clytemnestra, his wife, at home in the palace. And she gets news that, oh, your daughter's gone to meet your husband. Then another messenger shows up and says, oh, your daughter is dead, and your husband's gone, and we think your husband may have killed her. Not a word from Agamemnon, who has gone for 10 years to fight this battle, to fight this great fight at the city of Troy. He eventually succeeds after 10 years. We know the whole story of the Trojan horse and everything, and they wipe everybody out. Right? He eventually succeeds, and he comes back home. Hail the conquering hero, right? Clytemnestra has had 10 years to stew on this, with not a word from her husband about what actually happened, what went on. When he comes home, his position is, he's ostensibly the most powerful man on the face of the earth, right? For a very short time. Basically for that boat ride from Troy back to Greece, back to Athens. Because Clytemnestra kills him for killing their daughter. She gets a bad rap for that, but I think it's well deserved. Right? I think that Agamemnon is the guy who's got, let's face it, I mean, that the Trojan War could have been over years earlier if Agamemnon hadn't been fighting with Achilles, right? His own greatest soldier. And here's the deal with this. Right? Here's how this connects to this poem. The resolution of this is, right, this violation, this rape that Zeus performs destroys the greatest civilization on the face of the earth, and then destroys the greatest man on the face of the earth. Does Leda know this? Well, and that's the big question at the end. Being so caught up, so mastered by the brute blood of the air. And then this question, which is certainly an exclamation. She put on his knowledge with his power before the indifferent beak could let her drop. Zeus, king of the gods, lots of knowledge. The god of thunder, right? And lightning, right? Lots of power. She puts it on. She doesn't have the power to create, but she certainly has the power to destroy. That's what her progeny do. And him, Zeus, at the end, indifferent, right? Absolutely unconcerned, powerless. So we go from Leda at the beginning, incredibly powerless, being attacked, to giving birth then, right? We know this in the future, giving birth to kind of the two of the most powerful women on the who bring down the greatest powerful civilization and the greatest powerful man on the face of the earth. And Zeus becomes indifferent, right? So that's the beginning of this gyre. You see, Zeus, the god, becomes a beast and conjoins with the human, right? So that begins this gyre, right? And he says it reaches its high point at the time of the oracles and then starts to fade for about 1,000 years when a new gyre comes along, where god, man, and beast get together again. And we all know it, right? It's the gyre of the dove. It's the gyre that Yeats believes we're in, but is slowly coming to an end. He says it reaches its high point at the civilization of Byzantium, where everything's in perfect balance. But we've been on a decline since then. And we get kind of God and man, right? We get that whole Christian gyre, because that's what this is, because that's what the play he's doing on the second coming. And where's the beast? Well, where is the beast? Scroll down a little bit farther there and you'll see where the beast is. It's not a swan, it's a dove. God becoming a beast. I've just got a few, literally hundreds of images I could have taken from this. This idea, I wanted them all to connect to the Annunciation, where we see the dove descending, right? The dove is this firm kind of constitution of the sense of the divine. And here in the second coming, right, he's writing this after World War I, the war to end all wars, right? the first war where people can deal death at a distance, where I can pull a string and somewhere 7 miles over the horizon, bunches of people can die from a biological agent. For the history of civilization, we've been able to right? War was about the same thing. You look at your enemy and you kill your enemy. Not so in World War I. And the irony is that we, on one hand, we've got that artillery that's firing, you know, gas bombs and, you know, biological agents. And then on the other hand, we've got trench warfare where every foot is fought over face to face. Yeats says this is just this collapse, this utter kind of loss of humanity. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. And he's talking about the winding down of this gyre, the dove, this Christian gyre. Right? He said, the gyre's getting wider and wider, and he says, it's like training a falcon. Right? If you let the falcon away, too far away, too early, it just never comes back. Right? The spiral gets too big. Things fall apart, as he says, and we end up with anarchy. There is no sense of order. The blood-dimmed tide is loose. And if you've ever seen the beginning of, Saving Private Ryan, that D-Day thing, that most harrowing probably 20 minutes of film, right? You know what a blood-dimmed tide is. And they're connected to the ceremony of innocence. Well, the ceremony of innocence, because he's going to use lots of Christian imagery as well as mythic imagery here, right? The ceremony of innocence for a Christian, a celebration of innocence and a reconstitution of innocence, a welcoming into the community, is baptism. And baptism is usually performed with water. But that water is mixed now with blood. And instead of welcoming a new life, you drown that new life. Why? Because the best of us, we have no ideas or no convictions. And the worst, right, are full of passion and intensity. Watch the late night televangelist, you know that. So surely, he says, right, some great moment is about to happen, right? What do Christians want? What are they looking for? And Yeats himself obviously is not a Christian, but he says, Christians are looking for this idea of the second coming, right? Christ is going to come again. But it's not that 8-pound, 10-ounce Talladega Nights baby Jesus. No, it's the Pontecrator. It's the judge, or he's going to switch from Christian imagery here and give us something, I think, a little scarier. Some revelation is at hand, right? Well, the last book about the apocalypse and the creation of a new heaven and a new earth and a new Jerusalem, revelation. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight, kind of the collective unconscious there. And it's this image of this, right? Somewhere in the sands of the desert, a shape with a lion body and the head of a man. A gaze blank and pitiless as the sun is moving its slow thighs. But now I know, right, the darkness drops again, but now I know the 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches toward Bethlehem to be born. This image here, this Sphinx, it's not the Sphinx at Giza, right, the ones that we would think of with a lion body and the head of a man. Now, this is something different. This is the Theban Sphinx. Again, borrowing from Greek myth, the story of Oedipus, right, who we know, right, inadvertently kills his father, marries his mother, right, but he gets acclaimed king of Thebes because there's this monster at the gates of Thebes who stops and asks all travelers one question. What walks on 4 legs in the morning, 2 legs in the afternoon, and 3 legs at evening? If you can answer it, the plague that's been upon Thebes will be lifted. If you can't, the Sphinx will kill you. Do you know the answer to that riddle? What walks on 4 legs in the morning, 2 legs in the afternoon, 3 legs at evening? It's a human being. We crawl, then we walk, and then we use a cane to walk, right? the diurnal imagery there of life as in the passage of one day. We're going to see later. Well, we already saw it with Keats, didn't we? Right, we saw that diurnal imagery. Right, there it is. Morning, evening, morning, afternoon, and evening. Right. What's the question behind the question there? Do you recognize what it is to be human? Do you know what it means to be a human being? Can you treat people like human beings? If you can't, why are you looking for the second coming? This is the judgment, right? It's not going to be these religious laws. It's not going to be these 9 million things. It's not going to be these dietary laws. It's not going to be how we dress. The fundamental question, did you treat others like human beings? Did you recognize them as human and treat them thus? That's the judgment. And that's a scary, scary judgment. But when that happens, there will be a new gyre for Yeats. That rough beast will come around again. And lion body, head of a man, right? The divine's in here as well. We've got the creation, the constitution of a new gyre out from out of the ruins of this current gyre, right? This Yeats participates in that pessimism that's there at the end of World War I that's so obvious for us. All right, and I've carried this a little too long, but this is Yeats. He's significant. We need to spend time with him.